This is Pittsburgh section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. This is Betty Purr interviewing Margie Weiner. Date is August 8th. This is tape 2, side 1. Margie, would you mind giving me your address?
145 Crescent Drive, Mount Lebanon, Pittsburgh, 15228.
Margie, would you tell me something? On the first interview, I did ask you something about your family life, but I'm just curious if you could tell me a little more about the Jewishness, if we could say it that way, as you were growing up.
Well, that's a very ambiguous part of my life. We knew we were Jewish, number one. We had a heritage, number two. But both of my maternal and paternal grandparents were not really religious.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, my grandfather, Harry Pally, could be something of an agnostic. I think that was the word they used in those days. Not an atheist. You know, there is a difference between them.
Mm-hmm.
He was an agnostic. He did not really believe in scheduled, regulated religious education. Neither my father nor my uncle were bar mitzvah. They went to services, religious services, just on the high holidays. When my mother and father were married, they were married in a synagogue, and as they were raising their children, of course, as I said earlier, they were Rod of Sholem members, and we all went to religious school, but my brother was not bar mitzvah. We were all confirmed. So it wasn't what you would call the studied religious tradition background. We never had a kosher home. My mother made marvelous baked ham, really. And all of my aunts and my one uncle lived the same kind of Jewish life that we did. I guess that you could say that they wanted their religious affiliation shown in their community work.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mother and my father and my uncle were very active in the Jewish community early in their young married lives, organization-wise, but not religious.
Mm-hmm.
Ways.
Well, you didn't have any further Jewish education other than being confirmed.
No.
You didn't go on
no.
any further in your studies.
No.
Another thing that possibly I did ask you, but I don't remember, could you give me your brother and sister's names?
Sure. Starting from the top?
Starting from the top.
The oldest one is Frances, F-R-A-N-C-E-S. She is now 77 years old. She lives here in Pittsburgh in the Fairfax.
Mm-hmm.
And I am her sole next of kin mm-hmm. in everything. She's my responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I take care of her every way that I possibly can. She's a semi-invalid, except financially. She mm-hmm. is financially secure. My next, she was married, she was divorced, she was widowed, she's been through the mill.
Mm-hmm.
She is, our kids would call her their Auntie Mame.
Mm.
That was her personality. She graduated from Peabody High School and went to Montefiore Nursing School, mm-hmm. but dropped out. That was in the early 30s. And then my next sister, Dorothy, who was known throughout Squirrel Hill as Dodo, graduated from Schenley High School because at that time when we were living in Squirrel Hill, Alderdice had not been completed yet. So they had to go to Schenley or Peabody. And Dodo is now living in California. She just celebrated her 75th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
She married a Pittsburgher by the name of Herbert Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D-T, whose father was president of the Beth Sholem congregation for many, many years. Then came my brother, whose name was I. Nevin, N-E-V-I-N, Pally. The Nevin name keeps cropping up in our mm-hmm. family because it was my paternal grandmother's maiden name.
Mm-hmm.
Nevin graduated from Alderdice. Isaac. But he never liked the name Isaac. So it was always Nevin. And went to Carnegie Institute of Technology, as it was known then. It is now Carnegie Mellon.
Mm-hmm.
As an aeronautical engineer. He was an avid golfer, was in the amateur tournaments throughout Pittsburgh area. And in his aeronautical engineering career, he was affiliated with many of the aircraft companies. In the early 40s, he was then made vice president of Martin Marietta. He lived in Denver, in California. And during the Second World War, was one of the assistant secretaries of the Navy in the air space program. One of my greatest thrills was being invited to go to the 10th anniversary of NASA with him as his hostess, which was held in Washington, D.C. He was written up in Who's Who. He was quite a man.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up in St. Croix as president of Martin Marietta plant in St. Croix, and it was there that he died 3 years ago.
Hmm.
And I had, he was not a practicing Jew in that he did not marry Jewish women, either of his wives, but at the funeral, he was buried at sea off St. Croix. The funeral was held at the pier in Christiansted, and the entire island came there, and three of the men came over from St. Thomas, where there is a Jewish congregation. There's a tiny little synagogue over there that is just beautiful. But one of my nephews knew that it would please me to have them at the funeral. And they were very generous and helped me recite the Kaddish for my brother as we got on the boat with the coffin and went out to sea. Next, my sister Lois, who also graduated Alderdice and married Burl Thompson, T-U-M-P-S-O-N, and they were quite active in the business community here in Pittsburgh. She died just 1 month before my brother did, of cancer. And they were married in 1940, Lois and Burl, and somehow there was another Thompson around whose name was Ellis, and we got...
Related?
Well, there were brothers.
That's what I thought.
So two sisters married two brothers.
That's interesting.
And then there was me.
Yeah.
Well, the sisters marrying brothers is not uncommon in my family. There were two Pally girls, my aunts, who married two Solof men, S-O-L-O-F, who were brothers.
Hmm.
And it's been known to happen in other families, too.
I'm sure it has.
So it was nothing new in our family.
We have a very interesting family.
Well, there were 7 in the original Pally family, and there were 5 in my Pally family. And when you have large families, you have many stories, and you have a lot of give and take and a lot of ups and downs.
Tell me, in the first interview, you mentioned that you had moved in the Depression. Do you remember anything about it, what it was like? I realize it was probably rough because everybody had it rough during the Depression, but I mean, do you remember anything in particular?
Well, of course, I was, 8 years old during that time. I think that the important thing that I remember is, and it's been brought up to me in later years, I never throw anything away. I'm a compulsive saver of goodness knows what all. Because being brought up in the Depression, you always made do with what you had. And you never threw anything away because you figured that sooner or later you might need it. We lived on Hobart Street at the time, and everybody was in the same financial bind, really. Of course, food was cheap, but you had to have the money to buy the food, even if it was cheap. I know my mother sold silk stockings to the teachers at Colfax School to earn pin money. If we went to the movie, it was 10 cents. And you rode on the streetcar for 8 cents. The tokens were 3 for a quarter. And the trip to town was a marvelous experience. On a Saturday to go into town and just walk around and shop. The activities were completely different. We had radios, of course. Wasn't that bad. But you made your own fun, which the children don't do today, I don't think. They're controlled by their peers, which we were not. I always had a bank account because I can remember every Tuesday my mother would give me 25 cents to take to school because that was your bank account.
Yeah.
And the banks would sit there in the school and take the money from the children. So it was a savings like that. My father always had a car. We were always dressed well. My parents had a large social circle, very friendly, and through the years they kept that friendship. In fact, one of my mother's closest friends was Helen Orringer, who was celebrating her 100th birthday. I don't know if you know her.
No.
And well, the Abe and Helen Orringer school is up there on the Hillel school is on Beacon Street. They were very philanthropic in the community. A lot of them have died, but a lot of them are still around.
Tell me, as far as high school, would you say there were any teachers in particular that had influence on you as far as you going to college and what to study and so forth?
No, not really. I must admit that I was more interested in people and social activities in my last couple of years of high school than I was in the academic end of it. I always had a good time. I guess I was fun to be with, and I was attractive enough to never have to worry about dates. And it continued on that way through college. I knew that I wasn't going to have a career, per se, but I always enjoyed reading and writing, so that's why I started in with the major in English and journalism.
All right, one more. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Pally's Paws.
What?
What is it called, Pally's, what is it, the paper?
at University of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Oh, the Pitt News.
No, no, not the Pitt News. Wasn't there something?
Well, I wrote a column for the Pitt News called Pally Pores. P-O-U-R-S.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Pally Pores.
P-O-U-R-S.
Right.
Pally Port.
And it was a weekly column.
That's what I wanted to know more about it.
It was really a conglomeration of little tidbits and things that I would pick up from reading the newspaper, listening to the radio.
I see.
And it was purely a column of my reactions and feelings towards certain things. As a matter of fact, if you remember, he just died a while ago. He had a column in the Chronicle by him. Turn that off a minute. Anyway, it was a personal reaction to things. You had your own personal ideas about certain things when the New Deal came in and when politics were around and the Socialist Party that was very active in Pittsburgh at that time. And you just, whatever I wrote,
mm-hmm.
people read.
Mm-hmm. Were you talking about Mr. Bloom? Is that who
Milt Sussman.
Oh, Sussman. Okay.
Milt Sussman's column in the Chronicle mm-hmm. was essentially the same. He just gave his own ideas on mm-hmm. certain things that were coming about at that mm-hmm. time. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And it continued on when I was first married. I worked in Washington, D.C., where my husband was in the Navy. And I worked for the National Housing Agency there doing critiques on legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out a weekly in-house paper talking about everything that was going on up on the Hill that would be pertinent and interesting to the people in the National Housing Agency.
Sounds interesting.
And then when we came back to Pittsburgh, of course, I didn't work. I was starting to raise a family.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the Jewish Chronicle, what years did you work for the Chronicle?
From 66 to 69.
For 3 years.
Yeah.
And you wrote an article for the Chronicle.
No,
right?
I was...
you were in the office. I know we did go over it before.
What
I
did was
exactly.
I was the female editor for the organizations and for the social pages. I did book reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of interviewing. I interviewed Alex Haley. I interviewed Robert St. John.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime there was a person of any note that came to Pittsburgh, usually to appear before a community organization as a speaker, we would do the interviews. And it was a wonderful experience, it really was. Rabbi Gittleson, I remember, a lot of people who have since made their name.
Mm-hmm. Marge, you mentioned that you had worked for the Israeli Bonds and the ZOA.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in particular, any great events, in anything that really stands out in your mind that you could remember that you'd like to tell us
well,
about?
Well, it's just that when I was president of Hadassah, we were very close with ZOA as the brother Zionist organization. And here in Pittsburgh, we developed a fine rapport, a fine working relationship with ZOA. I was always asked to sit at the head table at the ZOA dinners as president of Hadassah. For the Israel Bond Organization, it was an entirely different type of organization in that it was purely fundraising. You have to go out and sell bonds and sell the story of bonds. But it all ties in with the selling of Israel to the Jewish community. I think that you must be aware that there was, before 1948, an organized resistance to the establishment of the State of Israel here in Pittsburgh. There were groups of people who were anti-Zionist, as maybe that's too strong to say, but they were not sympathetic with the Zionist idea of the establishment of the State of Israel. Therefore, when Israel Bonds started functioning, it was a real selling job to interest people in buying bonds. It has since evolved into a very, very viable organization, in that they raised tremendous amounts of money for Israel through the Israel Bond Campaign, and serving on their board was I was happy to do it, and whatever contributions I made in that area, I think I feel very good about.
By any chance, were you ever involved in any civil rights movement or any of these activities? You know what I mean? Any this type of thing?
Well, I didn't march in Alabama.
You did or didn't?
Did not.
Oh. All right.
I protested the Vietnam War.
In what way? How?
Physically, I marched in Washington.
Oh, you did?
I sure did. As a matter of fact, right in the front row with Dr. Spock.
Do you remember,
I marched in Pittsburgh.
Did very many people go with you from Pittsburgh to Washington?
No, just two of my girls. That was all. But I didn't go on an organized group. I felt very strongly about it and went. What else? I've always been what you would call a liberal with women's rights, National Association of Colored People, NAACP, whatever, the ADA, American Civil Liberties Union.
Whatever you felt strong.
Yeah.
For.
No, whatever felt. I felt that the group was doing the hard work for what I believed was right. That's why I would affiliate myself with them.
I think it's wonderful.
And I haven't made any mistakes.
I think it's wonderful. I really do.
I might have been too vocal at times in what I felt was right, but with the National Council of Jewish Women's stands on the abortion, the right to choose, on gun control, which I feel very, very strongly about. That's one thing about council, that when they take a stand and they stand by their stand, it's important to me to be a part of that organization. Of course, you know, all of our nonprofit organizations cannot take political stands. They're not supposed to. But there are ways where you can discuss the, especially in a year like this, where you can discuss the pros and cons of an individual's candidacy in a way that allows for freedom of speech on each side. But 9 times out of 10, you can get your point across very easily. Especially when people say, well, there's, quote, a Jewish vote, unquote. Or there's a, quote, woman's vote, unquote. You cannot be a single issue voter, whether you're a woman, whether you're a Jew, whether you're black, whether you're white. You have to see the whole picture and know what is good not only for yourself but for the people with whom you live. And I mean the total community. Too many of us, I'm afraid, vote our pocketbook. And we're all very comfortable.
Yeah.
But I look around, and through my work with Call for Action, I see that there are many, many people who are not comfortable. I see elderly, senior citizens, really, who really can't even afford Meals on Wheels. I see them not having a decent place to live. And I see kids who need a job. And yet, when you hear some of the statements that are made, when they give you these statistics, you don't know how many people have been turned away from hospital care because they haven't had the money. They don't have Blue Cross and Blue Shield. These are things in our society that bother me, and I will never stop letting them bother me. And
you do something about
it. I try to do whatever I can.
Tell us more about this KDKA Call for Action.
Well, that's a very favorite topic of mine.
All right.
KDKA Radio sponsors the Call for Action project, which was started by Ellen Strauss in New York, because she knew that there was a need for a group of volunteers to try to help people who had problems. Mm-hmm. And Women in Urban Crisis, WIC, and National Council of Jewish Women got together to sponsor Call for Action here in Pittsburgh. And Jean Dickman, I think, was the guiding force from council getting it started. Moss, Amper, what's her married name now? Anyway, Moss Weaver was also a guiding light, and Betty Ann Simon. And it was Betty Ann Simon who contacted me and said, "I think that you would enjoy doing this work. Please come and do it." And I said, as soon as I'm through with my presidency of Hadassah, I will, which was in 1975. And this is a group of 50 dedicated volunteers who go through training and answer the phones at KDKA Radio, Call for Action, one day a week, from 11 until 2. So having 40 volunteers gives us about an average of 5 women a day for 5 days. And they're on the phones from 11 until 1 answering the questions. We give one day a week. I am head of the Speakers Bureau for Call for Action, and I've traveled all around the community in western Pennsylvania. I've gone to not just Allegheny County, in Washington County, too, that I've gone. And I tell them just what we do, how we help them, how we can help them. If we can't help them, we'll refer them to someone who can. We have so many varied calls. It's hard to pinpoint any of them. It's, as I said, it's amazing to know the number of people who have problems and don't know where to go and who to call and who to turn to. So when they call us, either we help them or we refer them to someone who can help them. We have a tremendous resource book that is all filled with social agencies, with government agencies, with legal help, with senior citizen help, with everything. But we act as ombudsmen, and I think that it's an interesting sidelight that both Betty Ann Simon and I sat on the Community Relations Urban Foundations Committee for a couple of years together. And the Urban Foundations Committee of the CRC was looking for a project, and it came to mind through our Call for Action work I said, well, you know, there's a group in Baltimore, Maryland, that has established what they call an energy fund to help low-income people pay their utility bills. So they asked Betty Ann and I to research this for a project, which we did. And fortunately for me, but unfortunately for Betty Ann, I go away in the winter, so I'm not around town. And the whole thing fell in her lap after our original research work. But still, it was Betty Ann Simon from Call for Action background who established the Dollar Energy Fund here in Pittsburgh. She got all of the Great. Other community agencies, the churches, the diocese rather, the utility companies banded together, and she is still chairman of the Dollar Energy Fund. Anytime you get a utility bill, and you'll see on the bottom, would you please contribute $1 to yes. the Dollar Energy Fund, that dollar is matched by the utility companies to help